I'm VOA's Joe Ramsey with this worldwide news update. U.S. President Donald Trump says his Ukrainian counterpart will visit the White House this week to sign a long-sought minerals deal. AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
The president said the deal will give the U.S. access to Ukraine's deposit of rare earth minerals, vital for high-tech industries. He bills it as a chance for Kyiv to pay back the U.S. for hundreds of billions in war aid under Joe Biden.
Now we're going to be getting all of that money back, plus a lot more.
Meantime, Ukraine's Volodymyr Zelensky says the framework of a deal has been reached, but it does not include security guarantees.
If we don't have it, nothing will work.
The president's non-committal.
I'm not going to make security guarantees beyond very much.
And the full deal could hinge on Friday's meeting. Sagar Magani at the White House.
British Prime Minister Keir Starmer heads to Washington on a trip aimed at persuading President Trump to maintain military support for Ukraine. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
Starmer's told lawmakers Kyiv must be at the table for any negotiations.
This is about the sovereignty of Ukraine and their ability to decide for themselves the future of their country.
He adds Britain's ready to play a role in providing security guarantees to Ukraine, but reiterates the plan would require US backing.
It's vital that we continue in that role, and that's why my message to President Trump is that the relationship between our two countries needs to go from strength to strength.
Britain's leader echoed earlier prime ministers in emphasizing the special relationship. Starmer's due to meet Trump at the White House on Thursday. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
This is VOA News. Israelis have mourned a family that was a symbol of the trauma their country suffered in the Hamas-led October 7th, 2023 terror attack. Reuters correspondent Zachary Goldman reports.
Israelis on Wednesday mourned three members of the Bibas family. They lined the funeral procession that carried the bodies of mother Shiri and her sons, four-year-old Ariel and nine-month-old Kfir, on the way to their funeral. The two children were the youngest hostages seized during the attack on Israel. Their bodies were returned to Israel last week as part of a Gaza ceasefire meant to facilitate the return of captives and the release of Palestinian prisoners held in Israel. Thousands of people, some in tears, carrying blue and white Israeli flags or photographs of the family, walked in procession or waited as a convoy bearing the coffins passed their way to the funeral. The Hamas attack killed 1,200 people, according to Israeli tallies. Militants took 251 captives back to Gaza. Israel's air and ground war in Gaza, in response, has killed more than 48,000 Palestinians, according to Gaza health authorities, and destroyed most of the coastal enclave. But fighting has stopped since the fragile ceasefire agreement brokered by Egyptian and Qatari mediators last month. Under the deal, Hamas agreed to hand over 33 Israeli hostages in exchange for some 2,000 Palestinian prisoners and detainees, and the withdrawal of Israeli troops from some of their positions in Gaza, as well as a massive influx of aid. On Wednesday, Egyptian mediators confirmed they had secured a breakthrough that should allow the handover of the final four hostage bodies due in the first phase of the deal this week after a days-long impasse.
Reuters correspondent Zachary Goldman. President Trump says he backs billionaire Elon Musk's U.S. government cost-cutting effort. Reuters correspondent Alex Cohen has more.
Musk addressed Trump's first cabinet meeting of the new administration, saying his mission to cut government spending was urgent.
If we're spending like over $1 trillion on interest, if this continues, the country will become de facto bankrupt. It's not an optional thing. It is an essential thing. That's the reason I'm here.
Trump continued to give his full backing to Musk's Department of Government Efficiency cost-cutting team known as DOGE. Federal workers are unhappy with Musk's approach and have sued to protect their jobs, as have other groups who are seeking to block DOGE from accessing government systems and slashing programs. While Musk has waved a chainsaw on stage at a political event in a bold display of his group's efforts, his official role remains unclear, which has complicated the lawsuits against Stoge.
Reuters correspondent Alex Cohen. That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website, voanews.com. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barton, Washington. Today is Thursday, February 27th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The UN Security Council is called upon to do more to protect Sudanese civilians.
We call on the Security Council and all member states with influence to take immediate action to ensure all actors comply with international humanitarian law and protect civilians.
The UN says 50,000 people fleeing conflict in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo have crossed into Burundi. The chairman of Tanzania's main opposition party clarifies his no reforms, no election policy. More and more audiences are consuming news media through social media in Kenya. Nigeria warns that terrorist groups are adapting tactics and leveraging new technologies. Malawi's president withdraws misleading parts of his speech delivered before parliament.
Madam Speaker, in compliance with the rules of this House, I hereby withdraw the fraction of data in my State of the Nation address that have been queried.
And Trump says the U.S. and Ukraine to sign rare earth minerals deal. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The Director of Operations and Advocacy for the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, also known as OCHA, has called on the Security Council to do more to protect Sudanese civilians, including making humanitarian access possible and mobilizing funding. Idem Wosonu briefed the UN Security Council on Wednesday in New York on the situation in Sudan and South Sudan.
Nearly 2 years of relentless conflict in Sudan have inflicted immense suffering and turned parts of the country into a hellscape. Some of the humanitarian dimensions of this crisis bear repeating. More than 12 million people displaced, including 3.4 million people who have fled across Sudan's borders. More than half of the country, 24.6 million people, experiencing acute hunger. A collapse of health services. Millions of traumatized children cut off from formal education, relentless patterns of sexual violence. In several parts of the country, the already catastrophic situation of civilians has also actually worsened since our last briefing to this council less than 1 month ago. Mr. President, last week, Under Secretary General Fletcher and the High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, launched the 2025 response plans for Sudan and the region. Together, these plans require $6 billion U.S. dollars. This is a staggering amount of money, larger than any United Nations coordinated appeal in the history of Sudan. But as USG Fletcher said last week, this is a humanitarian crisis that is unprecedented in its scale and its gravity. And it is a crisis that is increasingly crossing Sudan's borders. The international community, in particular members of the Council, must spare no effort to mitigate this. Mr. President, let me conclude with three asks. First, protection of civilians. We call on the Security Council and all member states with influence to take immediate action to ensure all actors comply with international humanitarian law and protect civilians and the infrastructure and services they so much rely on. Second, and equally important under international humanitarian law, access. We need real implementation of the repeated commitments to facilitate and enable unhindered, unfettered humanitarian access to civilians in need. Third, funding. As we have said, the scale of Sudan's needs is unprecedented and requires an equally unprecedented mobilization of international support, including flexible funding. The people of Sudan deserve better, from their leaders and from the international community. We must also do much more to support the communities that have opened their doors to the millions of people who have had to flee, both within Sudan and neighboring countries.
Ide Wosonu is the Director of Operations and Advocacy for the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, also known as OCHA. Also, at the UN Security Council on Wednesday, several members voiced concern over the declaration of a parallel government by Sudan's paramilitary rapid support forces, the RSF, while Kenya pushed back against accusations that it had recognized the entity. RSF rebels and their allies fighting government forces on Sunday agreed to form a rival government, triggering diplomatic tensions between Sudan and Kenya. The French news agency AFP reports that British Ambassador Barbara Woodward also expressed deep concern over the development. Envoys from France and China echoed that view, with Chinese Ambassador Foucault said the move risks increasing the fragmentation of Sudan. The United Nations says around 50,000 people have fled the conflict raging in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo and crossed into Burundi in the past 2 weeks. Reporter Eddie Isango of VOA's French and Lingala services spoke to UNHCR representative Brigitte Ino in Bujumbura, Burundi.
UNHCR in Burundi has been receiving quite a number of people coming from the DR Congo, running from the recent conflict in Congo, particularly those coming around Goma and Bukavu. Since the beginning of the year, we have been receiving many. It was a slow pace, but starting from the 14th of February, we have been receiving large numbers of people coming. And this is really overwhelming for Burundi, because the first time the country is receiving this large number of people in so many years.
So do you have an idea of how many refugees have crossed the border?
For the moment, we are talking of about 46,000 people who have crossed, and they are still coming in numbers. Like yesterday, we had like 3,000 people who crossed into Burundi. So the influx of people has not yet stopped. We are still receiving so many of them. I was saying in just about 2 weeks, the country has received over 40,000 people, which is quite a lot for a country like Burundi. There's no capacity, both from the government and the humanitarian actors who are in the country, to manage this emergency, particularly at this time where the resources are so scarce.
Are there wounded persons and pregnant women among those who have fled?
Yes, definitely. There are a mix of people who are crossing, but the majority we are seeing, we have lots of children among this population, children who are telling us that they don't know the whereabouts of their families. So separated children, unaccompanied minors, there are many just in one location, which is northeast of Burundi. In that location in Rugombo, the government has made available a stadium where people are staying in the open for the moment. No shelter, no proper facilities. So we have in that location more than 7,000 children. We also, from the medical record, there was about 2,500 women who were pregnant or lactating. So these are populations that really need a lot of support. The malnutrition rate is very high. From MSF and our health partner on the ground, they are talking about 11% of the children who are malnourished. So there are a number of, a lot of gaps in the response for the moment because of lack of resources for humanitarian activities in Burundi.
That was UNHCR representative Brigitte Ino speaking from Bujumbura, Burundi, with reporter Eddie Isango of VOA's French and Lingala services. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Mbati in Washington. Today is Thursday, February 27th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Malawi President Lazarus Chakwera has requested Parliament to remove a part of his State of the Nation address he made recently to the legislature, which opposition lawmakers say contains false information. President Chakwera made the announcement before the body on Wednesday while he was clarifying the contents of his widely criticized speech. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
Honourable members, I wish to welcome His Excellency Dr. Aldous MacArthur Chakwera
President Chakwera appeared before Parliament largely to respond to questions from lawmakers on the State of the Nation address he made on February 14. However, he said his appearance during the presidential question time was unique.
Its uniqueness is in the fact that I stand here today not merely as one accountable, but also as one accused. And both legal and natural justice demand that I face and answer my accusers.
Opposition lawmakers have long accused President Chakwera of spreading false information in Parliament while delivering the speech. In his remarks, President Chakwera highlighted various development projects across the country. He said his administration has achieved over his 4 years in office. However, opposition lawmakers said many of the projects mentioned had stalled, while others did not even exist. For example, in his speech, Chakwera said his administration has constructed 28 houses for security agency employees in Insanje district bordering Mozambique to improve security there. However, information on the ground reveals that only the foundations of all of the homes have been laid. Speaking in Parliament Wednesday, Chakwera admitted inaccuracies on some development projects. He, however, criticized opposition lawmakers for describing his entire speech as a pack of lies aimed at wooing Malawians to vote him into power again in September elections. Chakwera said only 2% of the information he provided from each of the country's 28 districts have been questioned.
I investigated the matter and found that the variants all emanated from a team of five technocrats who had inadvertently transferred 2% of the verified data from the ministries into the wrong categories of my unified data matrix.
He said he has since reprimanded the team, though he did not mention their names, and dismissed their team leader.
Madam Speaker, in compliance with the rules of this House, I hereby withdraw the fraction of data in my State of the Nation address that have been queried, and I humbly request your good office to have the vast majority and remainder of that address, which cannot be queried or disputed, remain in the record of the Hansard.
George Chaponda is the leader of opposition lawmakers in Parliament. He told VOA that President Chakwera was wrong to stick to most of the same criticized speech.
He would have come with a new sonar altogether, which is in line with Section 89, Subsection 3 of the Constitution. And then we would deliberate on that one. That would be the best.
Opposition lawmakers have avoided deliberations on President Chakwera's State of the Nation address, saying they could not address lies. And Chaponda said the opposition parliamentarians will continue to regard the Chakwera's State of the Nation address as a bag of falsehood. For VOA Africa, I am Lamek Masina in Blanta, Malawi.
The new chairman of Tanzania's main opposition, Chadema Party, has been clarifying his policy of, quote, no reforms, no elections in Tanzania. Tundu Lissu says the idea does not mean that Chadema will boycott the 2025 elections. Instead, he says the party will work to convince Tanzanians that such reforms are necessary if Tanzania is to have free and fair elections. The government says it has already implemented electoral reforms and that Chadema's fixation on them may be rooted in the party's lack of preparedness. Lissu denies the stance is causing unease among Chadema members who fear it could have a negative impact on overall preparedness. He tells me that Chadema will use peaceful and democratic means to bring about electoral reforms.
What we mean with no reform, no election is this: unless there are democratic electoral reforms, we will see to it that the elections do not take place this year.
Does this mean that Chadema will not participate in the election?
It is not a question of boycotting the election. elections. It is a question of preventing the elections from taking place.
But how do you prevent the elections from taking place?
Through mass democratic action, through peaceful democratic means that are recognized by our laws and that are recognized by laws in democratic countries worldwide.
That some people, particularly the government, says the reason U.S. talking like this is because Chadema is not ready for election.
Well, that is the kind of nonsense that can only come out of the government and the ruling party. Chadema has participated in general elections in this country since the very first election in 1995. We have come to this conclusion this time because now we know that there is no way under the current conditions in which free, fair, and credible elections can take place. And therefore, the reason we are calling for a no reform, no election is precisely that. We want to change the conditions under which elections have taken place in this country, which has led to murder and mayhem against our people. We want to participate in elections which are free, fair, and credible. We are no longer prepared to continue participating in elections that are manipulated by the government, that are stolen, that we are no longer prepared to condone the kind of electoral violence that has been meted out against our people by the ruling party and the government.
Is this policy the consensus of your leadership in Chadema, or there is some disagreement on this?
Well, this vision was adopted unanimously, firstly by the Central Committee of Chadema in early December of last year, and that decision was confirmed by the National Party Congress, which took place on January 21st of this year. So it is a unanimous decision of our party.
Before I let you go, Mr. Lissu, when is the party convention and are you going to stand for president?
Well, Mr. Bhatti, we are talking of preventing the elections if there are no democratic reforms. The question of us participating in the elections and me running for presidency will depend on whether we have democratic electoral reforms. If we don't, we will work to prevent the elections from taking place. And therefore, the question of us participating and me running will not even arise.
Tundu Lissu is the chair of Tanzania's main opposition Chadema party. He is now, he was speaking with us from the capital, Dar es Salaam. In Kenya, more and more audiences are consuming news via social media. The digital shift is changing the media landscape, with startups like Tuko emerging as a leader in fast-paced news for younger audiences. For VOA, Victoria Amunga meets the team to hear how they balance responsible journalism with the needs of a digital age.
In a busy newsroom in Kenya's capital, Nairobi, journalists at the digital media group Tuko put their skills to work. Tuko, which means we are in Swahili, started in 2015 and now boasts more than 30 million platform users each month. Walter Masolo Mabonga heads Tuko's editorial department of politics and current affairs. 57 young journalists work here. The 29-year-old says the speed with which the team gets content out is helping the outlet to thrive and edge out traditional media.
It is very swift in terms of proving stories and publishing. We don't have a lot of bureaucracy or stages like in the mostly in the mainstream media. There are a lot of, you know, gatekeeping.
Tuko is part of a wider digital shift. A Reuters Institute digital news report finds that in Kenya, 89% of news is now consumed online, and social media experienced the biggest increase, with 77% of people now getting news via those platforms. Tuko staff say audience trust their media outlet. Ruby Orina is the public relations manager at Tuko.
We're always interacting on social media, and we also have a very strong social media team that is always monitoring what's going on. And while we are listening to Kenyans and we're giving them this platform, we also do a lot of verification so that before a story runs there, it's not just a story for sensationalism, it's a story with facts.
Facts are important in the move to fast-paced digital news. The International Center for Journalists say that social media has enabled mis- and disinformation to spread more quickly and widely. But regulating digital platforms is tough, say Kenyan authorities. The Media Council of Kenya, a government body, says it can be hard to know who's running a site. Dina Ondari is the manager of research and monitoring at the Media Council of Kenya.
There are platforms that have mushroomed. Some of them, their ownership cannot even be established because of the nature of digital media. And therefore, it becomes difficult for regulators to identify who is behind these platforms.
As digital media expands, young journalists are seeing more job opportunities in a highly competitive industry, say officials with the Africa Digital Media Group. Mukui Mbindio is head of partnerships at the Africa Digital Media Group.
Someone who might have needed a whole news crew to be able to go out and tell a story can now do it on their phone. Even, you know, editing a story, there's, you know, new tools and software now to edit stories. There's even the proliferation of AI.
Media experts say combining traditional media standards with new digital tools will help sustain the Kenyan media. Victoria Amunga, VOA News, Nairobi.
President Donald Trump says Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky will be at the White House this Friday to sign an agreement granting the U.S. access to Ukraine's lucrative rare earth minerals. But Ukraine's leader says a few outstanding issues remain. White House correspondent Anita Powell reports from Washington.
A deal is in the air, says President Donald Trump, with Ukraine's president coming to the White House to sign a mineral agreement on Friday. The still-developing deal would give the U.S. substantial rights to Kyiv's lucrative rare earth minerals and compensate Washington for weapons sent to Ukraine to fight Russia's three-year war of aggression.
And we're going to be signing an agreement, which will be a very big agreement, and that'll be on rare earth and other things.
But Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky flagged a key pillar that is not in the current deal: concrete guarantees for Ukraine's security. Earlier Wednesday, Trump effectively dismissed a key Ukrainian wish: membership in NATO.
In this deal, there are only, you know, basic things about that. Yes, security guarantees and etc. But I think it's not about it. Next steps have to be about it. Without future security guarantees, we will not have really just peace, and we will not have really ceasefire, what Trump spoken about. And if we don't have it, nothing will work. So we will have nothing.
Elena Prokopenko of the German Marshall Fund says the minerals deal was part of Zelensky's original peace formulation.
It is difficult for the Ukrainian government to completely go back on the offer. Unfortunately, the deal, the draft deal that was offered to Ukraine in response to this proposal was quite disappointing and quite one-sided. But now that the arrangement seems to be much more balanced, the Ukrainian government is ready to sign it.
Prokopenko, a former advisor to Ukraine's finance minister, says she expects some finessing before the deal is signed.
There is some progress in terms of mentioning guarantees as a factor, but it will have to be much more detailed in the final deal, because at the moment there's no specific connection basically in between security and investments. As of now, it looks like an investment deal, but not as a security deal.
And there are other details still to be finalized before this brutal war can end. Russia now controls about a fifth of Ukraine's internationally recognized territory and has vowed to not give any of it back in a would-be peace settlement. Anita Powell, VOA News, Washington.
That's it for this Thursday, February 27th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for coming aboard with us this morning. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We're also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Barton in Washington, saying have a great day. And please be safe, whatever you do.